Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, April the 19th. Of course, Good Friday. We celebrate Good Friday today, and our Jewish friends are also celebrating Passover. So we salute everyone on these two very important religious holidays. Today we'll be chatting with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. We always like to check with him and see what he's thinking about the situation in the country. We're going to do a couple of segments. In the first segment, we'll focus more on President Trump, in the aftermath of the Mueller report being published. It's online. You can read it if you want to, obviously redacted for obvious reasons, but it's available online. And what exactly is the impact? I mean, what happens politically after that report? I happen to think that I think that report is really in the back view, and I think most Americans want to get over this. I was looking at a Gallup poll that says that Americans are concerned about immigration, healthcare, and the economy. Now, economy is always a major concern for people when they do these polls, but I don't see investigations anywhere on that list, and that may be hopefully a message to the Democrats that, you know, if you go into this immigration, into this investigation thing, it's probably not going to end well for them. And then in the second segment, we'll take a look at the Democrats and the 2020 Democrats. We understand that Vice President Biden is going to be coming in at any moment, probably sometime this month. So that would bring, you know, certainly one of the more experienced candidates into the mix, and we'll see how that shakes things up. If you look at most of the polls so far, the Vice President Biden is leading in most of the polls, but it's certainly not a done deal. Bernie Sanders is gaining a lot of strength and so on and so on. Let me see if our friend Barry's on the phone. How are you, Barry?
I'm good. It's nice to talk to you, as always.
Well, happy Passover to you, and happy Easter to all of our Christian friends. So it's always good when these two things happen together. We get a chance to focus on our religions, Barry.
Well, they're, of course, inextricably linked. The Last Supper was, of course, the Passover Seder. And so Passover and Easter are... it's one of the major links to the two religions, and we can celebrate them together in great accord.
That's exactly right, and that's one of the beauties of the United States, that, you know, we can do that. We can celebrate those two major happenings and do so peacefully and respectfully with each other. Well, I was watching, before we get into the current events, I was watching a photo. I saw a photo the other day of the Twins stadium up in Minneapolis, and it was snowed out. So I guess you've had some you've had a long winter up there, Barry.
We did, but now as we speak, it's 60, and it's already dark. It's going to be in the 70s for the next week. So we have spring.
And great. I think that's good.
I mean, you never know for sure, but I think an Arctic vortex has spent its last dime in Minnesota.
Good. Well, I'm sure that after a long winter, I remember when I lived in Wisconsin, that when you got to April, you really wanted to forget about winter and say goodbye and say, hey, let's have a little spring. Let's have a little summer. So down here, it's absolutely lovely today, and it's supposed to be lovely as well this weekend. Well, a couple of big things since we last spoke. The Mueller report is now online. People can read it. I want to get your thoughts on that. And then, of course, the Democrats have a lot of people running. There's some interesting candidates, but I'm not sure, at least my opinion is, I'm not sure any of them at this point can defeat President Trump, but that's an early prediction. These things can change. So where are we in your mind, Barry? Where are we now that this Mueller report is online and that there's no collusion? And where are we politically, Barry?
Well, the report is pretty definitive, but it has certainly the collusion issue is a dead issue. There's nothing there, nothing. Mueller concluded the president did not collude. The Russians reached out, but they were rebuffed. And in fact, if there's any collusion at all, it remains to be investigated, perhaps, on the other side. The obstruction of justice requires, by law, a crime to have been committed, and since the Mueller report assesses that there's no crimes committed, there is no obstruction of justice, though the language of both Mr. Barr and Mr. Mueller indicates they don't absolve the president. Well, that's legally meaningless. I think it's the Mueller report, after all those months and those millions of dollars spent and all those investigators, all of whom were hostile to the president and his administration, all of them. There wasn't a single lawyer, including Mueller himself, who were at all in the least bit sympathetic to the president. So if those folks, and they were rigorous and aggressive in their investigation, if they came up with nothing after 21 months, then I think we can safely conclude that we move that behind us. But the Democrats clearly are not going to let go, and they will, as you, I think you suggested, they will increasingly turn off the public at large. They will not turn off their base. Their base wants them to continue. Their base is absolutely convinced the president is a bad guy and guilty of everything possible. And they say, even in their, even the media, who are their accomplices, if you will, are saying it doesn't matter whether what the Mueller report says. It's their guilt. He's guilty. You know, that kind of thing. Well, that's just not going to hold up in people, in the court of public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats have a wonderful opportunity to win this 2020 election.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Trump, from the Electoral College point of view, was, may not be any longer, but was very vulnerable. And as
mm-hmm.
you recall, in my Prairie Editor column, I said specifically in January and February that I saw a very, very difficult path for the president's reelection. Because, primarily, because of 2018, we saw that where he had the key states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Indiana, and Florida, those key states that he won, every one of them, were looking, except for Indiana and maybe Ohio, he was not looking very good. And Ohio looked very vulnerable. Now, only 3 or 4 months later, this pursuit of the president past its shelf life of credibility has cost them dearly. I saw reports, credible reports, saying Ohio and Florida are no longer battlegrounds. I mean, you never say never, but they don't look like battlegrounds anymore. And Pennsylvania and Michigan increasingly look, and even Wisconsin, especially with that election of that Supreme Court justice, the Republican conservative, which was a big surprise and an upset in Wisconsin. We now are beginning to think that the president can not only carry all or most of those key states,
mm-hmm.
but even add a few, such as
mm-hmm.
Virginia, where the Democrats are in disarray,
mm-hmm.
and Arizona, New Mexico, and Nevada, which he lost.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the situation is now becoming going from extremely favorable to the Democrats in January and February by their own actions. The Republicans are doing nothing. In fact, if anything, if I may say so, you may not agree with me, I think the Republicans are fairly inept here.
Yes, they are. I agree with you.
Not very aggressive. And so I'm no big fan of the Republican strategy. But nevertheless, the Democrats seem determined to reelect the president, even though, in fact, we know they don't want that. But they're so caught up in trying to, you know, here we are in 2019, and they're still trying to undo 2016.
Right.
As you and I have said this several times on this show,
sure.
If they would only concentrate on 2020, they have an excellent opportunity to regain the presidency and possibly, I mean, I don't know about the Senate, but certainly keep the House. Now, even the House majority, which they gained by winning 40 seats in 2018, at least, and they only need 19 or 20, I believe, to regain control, the Republicans to regain control. And it now looks like there may be 25 Democratic-held incumbents who are in trouble or who are resigning. I think it was Mr. Loebsank, I don't know if I pronounced it right, from Iowa, southeastern Iowa, who beat a Republican incumbent in 2018, has just retired. And that particular district was carried by Mr. Trump and could probably well be carried again. So we're seeing a chance for Republicans. I mean, Democrats now have to defend those seats they won by very small margins. And since they're doing everything they can, especially in terms of those districts which are purple, those districts are not necessarily negative to the president. They certainly, in some of those districts where there were very large urban areas where there were suburban women who switched from Republican to Democrat. But now we're seeing, and you and I discussed this the last time we spoke, inroads among Hispanic, Jewish, and even among black voters by the president and his party.
Right.
So
we have
I mean, the job situation for minority groups, Hispanics and blacks especially, is so good. You're beginning to wonder, are black and Hispanic voters prepared to vote out an administration which has, at least on the face of it, given them historically high employment? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Now, things can change.
Sure.
And you and I know that, and you've been very clear about that, as I have. But it doesn't make any sense. You know, the Republicans were very, and I think this was a criticism I have of the president. He was so eager to have Obamacare repealed again without a replacement ready. And, of course, we know that is a formula for defeat. Because even though Obamacare was opposed by voters, they wanted something to replace it, something much more
Affordable, if nothing else.
Republican or conservative, but still something which would have at least given them security of health care. And to do nothing, simply repeal Obamacare, is a formula for disaster. And so the Republicans were on the road to do that until Mr. McConnell very wisely said to the president, no, we're just not going to do that. We're not going to repeal Obamacare until after the election because we're not going to create a sense of insecurity among voters who care about that. And it's a legitimate issue.
Sure was.
Health care is a legitimate issue.
Well,
Obamacare may be full of faults, but that doesn't mean that we don't have to do something that's viable and makes common sense and appeals to a significant number of Americans who are vulnerable. So,
no, you're right about that. I mean, you have to, I mentioned in the introduction, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to that, but I mentioned in the introduction that this Gallup poll that comes out twice a year, I think, or at least once a year, where they ask people what they're concerned about. And the three topics are immigration, healthcare, and the economy. And if you remember in 2018, that, like you were saying about many of these so-called moderates in these purple districts, that's what they ran on. Not so much immigration, but certainly health care. And the Democrats, the more they focus on investigating Trump, the more oxygen they take from these moderates who want to get something. I mean, there's probably about 30 or 40 Democrats in the House, Barry, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's probably 30 or 40 Democrats in the House who would love to cut a deal with the Republicans on health care or immigration or other issues like that, but they're prevented from doing that by a House leadership that is apparently betting on that their best philosophy is just saying no to Trump. So, I mean, they're putting those seats at risk. And like you said, the majority is only 18. So the Republicans only have to pick up 19 and they're back in the majority. And if it's a wave election with a, you know, President Trump winning easily, then, you know, you might pick up more than that. So what I think, Barry, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I think is that over the next few months, there's going to be a real conflict, if it isn't happening already, in the Democrat Party between these moderates who want to get reelected in these purple districts and the party that a general party that is becoming more and more the party of these three women, the lady from Minnesota, the lady from Michigan, and the lady from New York, who these three have become the face of the party. They're the ones who get all the attention, Barry.
Well, and also there's candidates in the Senate for both president and people who aren't even running for president. Maxine Waters is not running for president, but she's the face of it, as is Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris. They're all and Mr. Booker, certainly, they're all advocating pretty leftist and radical views relative to what's normally offered by liberals. I mean, the liberal argument is I may not completely agree with it or even agree with most of it, but it's a legitimate point of view in American politics. And it's mainstream liberal view, which is progressive. It may be something that is opposed by conservatives, but it's a legitimate area for voters to consider. But when you have, and by the way, the same is true on far right. When the far right conservative groups bring up things which are way off the center, they are rightfully rejected by the voters. And the same is true on the left. And it's been this way for 225 years.
That's
so
right.
I don't think we're about to abandon it.
You're right. Remember when the Republicans had that that fellow from Arizona who really took some very harsh positions on immigration. I can't think of his name right now. The sheriff, I think, was his name. He turned off a lot of people. He turned me off, okay? And I'm a Republican. So you're right. I think these people and this lady up in Michigan, I mean, in Minnesota, in your part of the world, I mean, this lady is, every time she speaks, she's a controversy, Barry.
Well, she's the mirror image on the left of perhaps of the tactics of the president. Only the president appeals to a much larger base than she does. She has a very small base, mostly located in large urban areas, many of whom are not even voting citizens, and are, if they are, they're more recent citizens, and come from countries where socialism or social welfare was the norm. And they don't seem to understand that that's not what America does. We do a lot of social welfare, although many of those programs have not worked out. But some of them do, Social Security,
Medicare.
Not Medicare for all, but Medicare.
Right.
The prescription drug program. There are many, many excellent programs that are government-sponsored, and although we tend to think that the private sector can run things better, Social Security seems to be okay. It periodically gets to the point where it has to be adjusted, but So the people on the right who won't want any government thing, they want no protection for the elderly. I mean, that's silly.
Right.
And people who want everybody to have exactly the same, even though they don't even contribute, that's not mm-hmm. making much sense to voters either. So what
right.
we've got here is we've got what I keep coming back to, a golden opportunity for the Democratic Party, for the liberal side of the political argument in America, to regain not only power but regain its policy leadership in America. And instead of doing that, they are so obsessed with the personality and the foibles of Donald Trump and their shock, which still echoes of the 2016 election, that they can't turn their attention to the kind of programs and policy ideas that would appeal to voters and give them back the control.
There's no question that
that opportunity is there. I mean,
remember,
Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote. Now, a presidential election is not a popular vote election. I have to remind everybody of that. But that meant that because she did win the popular vote, she won a significant number of states in the Electoral College. And all she needed was three or four states that she did not win to have prevailed in the election. And that, for the Democratic nominee, whoever it's going to be, he or she, is an opportunity they especially had in January and February, and which is diminishing by the day and the week and the month.
We're going to take a little break, Barry, and then when we come back in the next segment, I want to develop this point that you're making about the 2020 Democrats and the opportunity they seem to be blowing. As we believe they are. We'll be right back. I want you to hear from my friend Carlos Gevez, my good friend here in Dallas.
This is Carlos Gevez Harpies. I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Tzatziki's at the Star, located at 6765 Winning Drive in Frisco. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy music at 6:30 until 9:30 p.m. Make your reservation today at 972-377-2276. Remember, Tzatziki's at the Star is the place to hang out on Saturday night. For upcoming dates, look for me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And we have a link to Carlo's website on the show information right under the show description, where you see the link to Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. Right under that, you'll see the link to Carlos Gevez, and you'll be able to see where he's playing around town. And he's playing in a lot of different places and doing very well in the Dallas area. We love Carlos. He's a great friend of our show, as well as a great friend overall. Let's get back to our good friend up in Minnesota, Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. Well, let's get into the Democrats 2020, because they sure have a lot of candidates who are running. And I know this is going to sound very partisan, and maybe it is, and I take responsibility for making a partisan statement. But I remember in 2016 that the Republicans also had a bunch of people running, Barry. But I look at the Republicans in 2020, and you had a lot of very successful governors, Donald Trump, that I certainly didn't think was going to win the nomination, but you had Jeb Bush, a successful governor in Florida, Scott Walker, governor in Wisconsin. There was some talk of Governor Perry, who was a very successful governor here, Governor Huckabee. You had others who were very successful in office. But when you look at this group of Democrats, and again, this may be very partisan, but I think it's true, they don't seem to have the same level of experience. You have a lot of people who have been in the Senate not even that long, some who have not even been in the Senate or been governors. I don't know. I don't see a lot of experience. Now, Vice President Biden is coming in. I suppose he'll bring some experience, but that's my impression. Not a lot of experience, Barry, in this group. So what's your assessment of the Democrats 2020, or at least this group of candidates?
I will gently disagree a bit, which we usually don't do, but I will. I think your looking at it, you are looking at it from a slightly more partisan viewpoint. I think, to be fair, in terms of experience and background, the Democrats of 2020 and the Republicans of 2016 aren't that far apart in that regard. Now, in terms of, and also it may be in terms of who might be a successful president. I mean, there were some very good, you know, interesting candidates on the Republican side in 2016, and look how badly they did with the voters against Donald Trump, who did not have any. He was a TV celebrity, and he ran a brilliant campaign that will go down in history, but it was totally unorthodox and totally unexpected. We'll wait and see what this Democratic field is. I think there's some interesting people in the Democratic field. I want to be really fair. I'm not a Republican, but certainly not a Democrat either. And I'm sort of on the center. And so I tend to be drawn to candidates who are more centrist. But I also have been doing this a long time, almost 50 years, covering presidential politics. 72 was my first professional coverage of a presidential election, and I've been doing it ever since. I've attended conventions. I've certainly interviewed most of the presidential candidates. I've been doing it a long time. Sometimes I guessed right, sometimes I didn't. But I learned that what looks good on paper often doesn't mean a lot to voters when they get to the point where they have to make votes, either in primaries or caucuses, or ultimately in a general election. The two don't necessarily match. For example, I was initially drawn to Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey in 2015, but he didn't have staying power. And a lot of people were drawn to Governor Bush, Jeb Bush, and he didn't have staying power. And there was Ted Cruz from your state, and he stayed a little longer, but he didn't have a lot of it. There was Governor Kasich of Ohio, who was considered a real heavyweight, and it turns out he didn't have what it took. Let's wait and see. I do think that those candidates who move way off the center, regardless of their charisma and skill, are very less likely to prevail. Remember, Donald Trump was not a Republican by background, nor was he in any way a bona fide conservative. Yet he ran as one, and he is governing as one. So again, he is, rather than moving off to the far right, he has gravitated towards the political center, the conservative center, admittedly.
Sure.
So when Democrats hear what I just said, they say, well, that's not right. He's not a center candidate. But from the point of view of his party, he is. And he not only that, but he kept his promises, something most presidential candidates, even those who win, never get to do. But so I think, and let's get specific. It looked like this guy from your own home state, Beto O'Rourke, was going to be a charismatic candidate. It now appears that his kind of place in the spectrum is being overshadowed by the Mayor Pete of South Bend, and who is the flavor of the week, the month. We'll see how long he lasts, but he's not without. He's certainly smart. And he's not without. He's certainly articulate. He has an interesting. He's only, some people will say, only a mayor, but he has a. He seems to have some kind of a way. And when he appears on TV, we'll see how he does in the debates. But he's a serious candidate. You mentioned Joe Biden. Joe Biden has had an extraordinary record. Certainly, you can't match his background, you know, youngest elected senator in history, a long-term senator, twice a presidential candidate, twice vice president of the United States, chairman of foreign relations, chairman of the judiciary, expert on foreign affairs. I mean, you can't take away his resume. Whether he has, beyond that, the ability to be a good president, that remains to be seen. But he certainly has the background. And then there's Bernie Sanders, who was the runner-up in 2016, and some people think he was unfairly denied the nomination. I could hear that argument because I wrote at the time that I thought the Democratic Party favored Mrs. Clinton and made it very possible for her to prevail and sort of shut out Mr. Sanders. But this time he's showing, so this time when he ran, I thought, well, he's 78 years old. He'd be 80 or 79 when he gets elected. He's clearly not going to be a strong candidate, and that's wrong. He is, in some of the polls, he's leading Biden in now the new polls. And he's showing tremendous grassroots support, including in Minnesota, where we have our own presidential candidate. And I already the articles in the local papers saying that Bernie Sanders, who did carry Minnesota in 2016 in the primary and the caucus, could easily win again. In fact, Amy Klobuchar, who's our own candidate, right now is in third place, according to some polls. And clearly, although she's certainly well-known and not unpopular, but as is happening in Iowa and Wisconsin, she does not seem to be catching on. Now, that could change when we get to debates. She may turn out to be a very skillful debater, and like Newt Gingrich in 2012, go from being sort of behind and being vaulted into the front strictly from his ability in the debates, because he was by far the best debater and most skillful. And we'll see who can do that. Nevertheless, and then we haven't heard really, Kamala Harris is raising some serious money, but Ms. Elizabeth Warren, Senator Booker, Amy Klobuchar, and Beto O'Rourke so far don't seem to be catching on. It seems to be other people catching on. But this is temporary, usually. And usually it goes cyclically, so that after a period of time, one candidate who's popular is replaced by another. Remember, Herman Cain, who's up for a cabinet post, at one point was very popular, and he faded. Mm-hmm. And so did your governor of Texas, who's
Barry.
Now a member of the cabinet. He had a moment.
That's right.
In fact, everybody had a moment in 2012 and 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to be very. So I want to be very cautious to the listeners of your program that anything I say is only for this moment,
mm-hmm.
because by the time we meet again, which hopefully will be in a month or so, as we normally do, things might be completely different.
That's
and
right.
I've
well,
been
if
cautious
you just,
why I'm making no predictions for 2020,
yeah.
because we really have no idea which Democrat is going to prevail.
Right.
It may even be one of the more radical candidates, although, as I've suggested and you've suggested,
mm-hmm.
and others have suggested, we're not alone, that if the Democrats go with a more radical candidate, diminish their opportunity to win in November significantly.
Right. Yeah. Well, you make some interesting points about, you know, predicting the future, because, as you said, you know, I think we did a show in, I think it was January or February, where you made the point that President Trump was going to have a tough re-election. And here we are 2 months later, and you're making the point that his chances are better. So things can change a great deal. I also go back, Barry, to April 2007, April 2015. I was not predicting in 2015 that Donald Trump would even be nominated. I thought he would be, I didn't think he would survive, honestly, the primaries. I thought he would be out early, if you remember some of the things I said back then. And certainly back in 2007, we were not doing these shows, but I didn't think that Senator Obama would defeat, you know, at the time, Senator Clinton and the Democrats. So things can change dramatically. And there's so much unknown, and so many things can go right, so many things can go wrong, that at the moment we just don't know. We're going to have to wait and see. It's like a ball game, you know. You got to wait and see what happens in the late innings or the middle innings. You know, you cannot base the game on what happens in the first inning. But I do think that the biggest challenge, and I'd like to make this last point. I want to get your reaction to what I'm saying. I think the biggest challenge in the Democrat Party is how to contain this irrational hatred of President Trump that I believe it could very well create a problem within the party that, as you say, they will blow the opportunity not just of the presidency but also keeping the House bearing. And maybe the Senate. There may be some Senate seats, too, where you know, beyond Alabama, where the Republicans could win. I don't really haven't looked too much into it, but I just think this irrational hatred of President Trump, Barry, is just it's killing the party, Barry. I think it's insane. It's not helping them one bit, Barry.
Well, I think you make an interesting point in about 2011, which you didn't mention. But in 2011, a lot of Republicans, maybe you and I too, if we're honest, had a somewhat over negative view of President Obama running for re-election. And we so embraced the candidacy of Mitt Romney that we allowed ourselves to be surprised on Election Day 2012, mainly because I think there was certainly an opportunity to defeat him. His Obamacare was unpopular. He even didn't do well in the first debate. And yet, the Republicans had nominated someone who became vulnerable to a very strong Democratic attack. There was the feeling against Obama was stronger than it perhaps should have been, just as we are now saying the feeling against President Trump is stronger than it should be by the Democrats. I think we're seeing parallels here. Republicans, I know, even, it was before we knew each other, so I didn't participate on your program until afterwards, but I don't believe. But I think in 2011, the conservatives and the anti-Obama Republicans were overconfident and a little bit and overdone in their opposition and didn't prepare for the kind of very effective campaign that President Obama's reelection was. And I think we can now make an analogy here between that and 2020, when again we have a controversial president running for re-election, unquestionably vulnerable, and yet the other party seems bent on not paying attention to the basics and allowing the incumbent party to prevail. Mm-hmm. So I think you've made a very good point that I've sort of made a riff on, but I think that I would like to close with that point that you made, which is
right,
that the Democrats, their delirium, which I've mm-hmm. used that word before, their anti-Trump delirium, and then, by the way, there's some Republicans who have it too.
And, that's right. I know.
And I think the problem is that very delirium is the is the problem. And it prevents the challenging party to effectively counteract the incumbent party. And I think that we're on the verge of that, but we still have, you know, more than a year to go.
Right.
Well,
no, I think you're exactly right. But just to
and
make,
we haven't even begun the debates.
That's
and
right.
When,
that's right.
And until
that
the debates
happen,
we don't know where this election is going.
That's right. Well, I'll just make one last point or one final point about, you know, what you were saying. On the night of the election 2012, I sat down to watch the returns, totally convinced that Mitt Romney was going to pull it out. I sat there at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. I was convinced that Mitt Romney was going to pull it out because I felt that, you know, I just felt that way. The polling, it was too close to call and all of that, and I thought Mitt Romney would pull it out. But I was wrong, as you say. President Obama ran a magnificent campaign, and that was that's all that it was. But, Barry, I want to thank you again for joining us. We'll do it soon, and I'm sure that when we visit again, we'll have a different electoral landscape. But as always, thank you for your time, and we love the Prairie Editor. It's a wonderful resource, and we certainly recommend it to all the listeners to click on that link and check out your wonderful resource, the Prairie Editor. You contribute so much to our country by your analysis and your very level-headed analysis, Barry.
Well, and happy Easter to you and to all your listeners.
Thank you so much. Happy Passover to you, Barry, and to all our listeners who believe in like you, who are celebrating that. And good night, and give my best to everyone up in Minnesota.
Well, at least we don't have any snow.
That's right. Okay. We certainly don't. We certainly don't this year. Thank you so much for your time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor up in Minnesota, one of our favorite friends. You know, I always tell people that one of the reasons I love Barry is because he's right down the middle. You know, he doesn't favor one side or the other, and I think it's good to have an analyst who is that way. You know, look, I do as much partisanship as anybody, and I read as many partisan things as everybody does, but when I read Barry, I always feel like I'm getting the straight stuff, so I love the Prairie Editor. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.